Today's July 20th, 2016, and the title of this exploration, or my title at least for it, is What Are You Worried About? Right? That's what I want to explore. And so the larger context is, as you probably know, we're exploring mindfulness this year, one of the Buddha's really innovative contributions 2,500 years ago, his deep exploration of mindfulness, the power of mindfulness, the use of mindfulness, and by the way, why love, warm-heartedness, really turbocharges your mindfulness. Really sweet, because otherwise mindfulness can become very dry and Spock-like. I've known a number of people who could write a master's thesis or a PhD dissertation on their own psychology. They're so mindful of it, you know. But they're as unhappy and neurotic and irritating as ever, right? So, you know, okay. So it's in that context then that the four places to locate or establish mindfulness that the Buddha identified, the four major places. We've focused some on the body, and now we're focusing on what has been translated as the feeling tone of experience, as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, or in modern terminology, the hedonic tone of experience. You know, is it painful? Is it pleasurable? Is it neither painful nor pleasurable? Or I personally would advocate and suggest that there's actually a fourth hedonic tone to experience that has to do with, is it relational or not? You know, we're not moving towards something pleasurable or away from something unpleasant, painful, but we're abiding as relatedness or not. And then there's the last category, none of the above, just sometimes called neutrality. In any case, we've started by focusing on the unpleasant, because that tends to be the most compelling, and also in terms of the evolution, biological evolution, including the evolution of the nervous system, being able to deal with that which is actually unpleasant in the moment or potentially unpleasant, anticipatory anxiety of the unpleasant is very, very compelling for survival. The unpleasant tends to have more urgency and impact for little jellyfish who had the first nervous system 600 million years or so ago, or lizards, mice, or monkeys who live in our heads today. You know, that which is unpleasant really needs to be paid attention to. So how do we practice with that? And last week we kind of explored in general different ways of being aware of the hedonic tone of experience. And in terms of unpleasant, I want to today particularly talk about mindfulness of fear. Okay. And so I invite you to pick something that you're worrying about these days, or, you know, apprehensive about, or uneasy about, or just maybe it's the usual mess. It's irritating, it's exasperating, it's stressful, it's hurtful, and there's anxiety in there as well. Okay? Now, very consistent with modern psychology, including kind of my own roots in the human potential movement in the 60s and 70s, the Buddha basically really recommended to go into the experience, not resist it or run away from it or try to change it immediately into something better. So I want to talk with you tonight about a kind of checklist almost, a very practical checklist for really opening into the unpleasant for many reasons, including the ways in which doing that very often helps the unpleasant to disentangle and break apart and pass along and pass away. Okay. This has to do with, in my view, the three ways to practice, three fundamental ways to engage the mind skillfully. The first being simply to be with what's there, to experience the experience fully, to allow the gestalt to complete so then it can move along. To feel the feelings fully. Of course, we need to have certain capabilities to do that, including understanding why in the world we're opening to the pain, right? The second great way to practice is to release the negative, like letting feelings flow, letting tension ease out of your body, dropping thoughts that are not helpful. And then the third great way to practice is to grow the wholesome, to grow what's beneficial, useful, skillful, psychological resources of various kinds, qualities of mind and heart and body that we can then draw upon as inner strengths down the long journey of life. Tonight I'm going to focus on the first of those, simply just being with what's there. In the process of being with what's there, it might change, but we're not deliberately trying to make efforts in our mind to alter what's there or to create something else. We're just really going into it. So one thing that'll make it real for you is to pick something that's on your mind tonight. You know, I don't recommend going into the white-hot core of your trauma history. You know, pick something mild to moderate. You know, I'm myself anxious about the fact that I need to get some stuff done, and I continually get, you know, pulled away from this material I'm reading about and writing about for the sake of, you know, the emails and to-dos that are coming in each day. Like, I'm not getting to something important. There's a kind of anxiety about that. All right? You might have other forms of anxiety, maybe an uneasiness in a relationship. Like, you feel unsettled, you know, it's unresolved. Or maybe you're dealing with a health scare or a genuine real issue, whatever it might be, okay? So, and I'll do this in kind of a little bit of a guided practice way, as think of it as an experiential experiment, and then we'll talk a bit about it, okay? So if you know what it is, one of the very first things to do, and I'll do this in terms of five aspects of experience. The first is to really explore the body sensations. What are the sensations of this in the body? You know, very often worrying is a defense against fear. It's a way to not feel the fear. Because we go up in our head and we kind of loop in worries or ruminations. So instead, just for a minute, I'll keep time. I love it that Mr. Rogers used to say that. Don't worry, I'll keep time. Anyway, for a minute, what's the physicality of this anxiety or worry? Where do you find it in your body? What are the actual sensations? See if you can really allow the sensations, really accept them, and let them flow. Okay? So that's the first box on the checklist, right? Can you really accept and allow and not be defended against or resist the body sensations? Obviously, there's a lot to that. You know, locating where in your body you tend to feel fear, exploring places that classically tend to hold, like in the belly, or the pelvic floor, or the back. Yeah. Okay. So then, the second place to be mindful of fear is, of course, in the emotions of fear. And being able to do what's called noting or just labeling a simple word. You know, like, oh, worry. Oh, apprehensive. Oh, gloom. Oh, dread. Just what are the emotions here? Or maybe there's just an image of an emotion, or just a sense of it. So I'll be quiet again for a minute. Really opening to and allowing and letting be the feelings of fear. It's always helpful to sense down to what's deeper, more vulnerable, or maybe younger, that's getting associated here. Okay. You okay so far? Just being with it? It's very interesting, you know. Have you begun to notice that as we really somehow receive in an undefended way, the anxiety tends to flow and lighten up? It's weird. You might be observing that. So now the third checklist is, of course, thoughts. Beliefs, ideas, views, particularly thoughts about how big a deal this is, you know, how threatening it is, or how likely the bad event is, or how terrible it would be if it happened. As a little detail, very often our thoughts about threats are very shaped by our learning from childhood. And as a child, three things were usually true. One, the bad event was really likely because you were in your situation. You were in your family, you were at a certain school, you had a certain coach, whatever. The bad event was really pretty likely. Second, when it happened, it felt horrible because as a kid, children tend to experience emotions much more intensively than adults. They don't have the same regulatory capacity that's evolved, that's matured rather in their nervous system of various kinds. So it really lands, like, gah, you know. And then third thing that happens when we're a kid, we don't have much resources to cope. We haven't learned how to cope with these intense experiences. So you see the transference into adulthood is, oh, the bad event is very likely, it'll feel horrible, and there's not much I can do about it. And yet, those three propositions are usually not true, systematically not true. The bad event is not that likely. If it did happen, it would be unpleasant, but it would be probably pretty much of a passing experience. Maybe not, never trying to minimize anything real, but just seeing clearly. And third, I have tons of resources with which to cope. And that can change our recognizing those three truths, pushing into the so-called delusion from childhood that's transferred into the present, can really be a helpful way to feel less threatened and more resourced based on reality. Okay, so I'll be quiet again for just a minute as you explore and just open to, oh, the thoughts you might have related to this thing you're worried about. Byron Katie, as you probably know, has a wonderful simple question about our views. Is it true? She has several other questions too, but that's a very good basic question. Is it actually true? So then the fourth checklist is desires, wants of various kinds, intentions, plans, wishes. So I'll be quiet again for a minute. Just opening to and really allowing to arise fully into consciousness, maybe from the background, your wants or desires, including desires not, you know, related to this worry. You might discover that some of the causes of the fear or worry are a drivenness toward a goal that you may not attain, or an attachment to a particular outcome or result. And then the last item on my suggested checklist here of five. What's the nature of all of these experiences that you're having? What's the nature of the experience of sensation? What's the nature of an emotion? What's the nature of a thought? What's the nature of a desire or want as an experience? And the Buddha's teaching, and particularly elaborated as Buddhism spread through Tibet, China, and Japan, a recognition that all experiences are like clouds, not bricks. We tend to thingify our experiences. It's a very effective way to help animals survive. It's called essentialize, or I say, let's say, thingify experience, turning each experience into, it feels like a static entity or it's a thing in the mind. And yet, actually, if you could observe directly, all experiences have a foamy, insubstantial, cloud-like quality. They're made up of parts, they're vibrating, they're wiggling, they pass away. They don't have absolute self-existence. In the technical sense, they're empty. They're real. They exist as an experience, but they're foamy. And insight directly into that takes us to non-clinging, because we realize, oh, you can't hold on to a cloud. You can hold on to a brick. You cannot hold on to a cloud. So I'll be quiet again as you just kind of reflect on the experiences you've been having or just experiencing right now. What's the nature of all experience as experience? And can you have vipassana, insight into that? Okay. I want to say one last little thing that I think is very cool from neuropsychology of learning, and very relevant. If you notice something's very interesting, as we move into the witnessing of our experience, right? Noting it, labeling it, observing it, feeling it, while also having a part of ourselves that's disengaged from it and standing apart from it, that is not disturbed. The witnessing is not disturbed. You know, the process of mindful inquiry or investigation into our own experience is itself not disturbed, right? We're investigating something disturbed, maybe, but the investigating itself has a kind of quality of calm, purposeful intactness to it. And that quality of calm, purposeful intactness, perhaps also with an awareness of a kind of background sense of well-being, that which is okay, observing that which is not okay, you know, or feels not okay inside our mind. With me so far? That's close. What's really neat is that learning or being changed or affected by our stressful experiences, including what we worry about, as well as irritated about and or feel hurt about, let's say, that learning involves the activity in the amygdala, the alarm bells of the brain, there are two, one on each side, involves the activity of two neurotransmitters / hormones, norepinephrine and cortisol. Okay? You don't need to worry about the details of this, although it's very neat and simple, actually, and mechanical, down in these subcortical regions that first evolved 200-ish or more million years ago. Okay. So stress hormones, in other words. What antidotes their effect? Two things that really interrupt the negative learning from stressful, fearful, including fearful experiences, is the activity of a different neurotransmitter system called GABA, which tracks calming and relaxation and tranquility. GABA. And also the activity of norepinephrine and cortisol in the amygdala is thwarted, if you will, or calmed down, downregulated by another neurotransmitter, neurochemical system, the natural opioids that track enjoyment, well-being, or pleasure. In other words, as you feel stressed or worried or are opening to that experience, if simultaneously other parts of you can feel relatively at peace or at ease or tranquil or relaxing or calm, GABA, and if other parts of you can track basic well-being, basic enjoyability of this moment, even though part of you is worried or agitated or rattled or frazzled or annoyed about something, that calming, that inner calming and inner enjoying will block the overlearning from negative, stressful, including anxiety-provoking experiences that we're very vulnerable to. Is that, like, really cool? And that's super science. Right? It doesn't mean you're being phony about your experience. You're not suppressing it. It's what's also true. You see? You can be rattled about this, and also I know that I'm fundamentally okay. You know, I'm bothered by this, and also there's a basic wallpaper background of well-being. You know, you're still rattled, you're still irritated, but the overlearning from it is interrupted. It's just a passing unpleasant experience, rather than causing damage, if you will, lasting impact. Pretty neat. Okay, what do you make of all this? How is that little exploration for you? The checklist, right? Sensations, emotions, thoughts, desires, and insight into the nature of experience, and a little headline about, cultivating over time an inner tranquility and inner well-being, so it is also present, at least in the background, even as you deal with stressful experiences. Good.
Question. If you have really big, overwhelming overwhelming negative emotions, possibilities.
Yeah.
It feels like it will take a really big resource and holding on to awareness to equal that, or can it be or dire?
Yeah.
Smart.
Right. So there are two things there. One is, see for yourself what's true. What has amazed me a lot personally, first, is that sometimes experiences are just so horrible that, frankly, just touch it and then back away. You know, it's like licking your finger to touch the hot stove, and that's enough for right now, right? And so that's true about certain things. But usually what's really interesting, if you fully open to the experience and just let yourself feel real bad, you rarely feel real bad for more than a few dozen seconds in a row, if that. Have you ever noticed that? You just can't do it. It just sort of clicks through you. And if you get stuck in it, you know, pull out of it. But very often, you're right, when if we just allow the feel, if we let ourselves really feel it rather than defending against it, we just kind of go, oh, okay. Very often, it doesn't really last that long. See for yourself if that's true for you. I'm not talking at all about re-traumatizing. It's more, you know, you want to maintain that sort of witnessing of it as you feel it. But that's the first thing. And then the second thing is, yeah, the more that we are prone to negative emotion, or maybe because we've had really painful, horrible things happen to us for good reason, we have big negative residues, you know, all the more reason to really build your other muscles. You know, looking for lots of little moments to take in the good, to register basic well-being, basic safety, and to really interrupt any kind of extra fueling of those negative fires. You know, very often the real issue is that we fuel them. You know, so that's what I have to say about that. Yeah, great.
It reminds me of how a little young kid will fall down and look at you to see if they should be hurt or not.
That's great.
And it's sort of like you do that with yourself.
That's wonderful metaphor. I relate to it well, too, as a dad. But yeah. That's great. Thank you very much. I'll use that in the future. Okay, good. No, thank you. So you all caught that, right? It's like being for us with ourselves. Yeah. Like, yeah, honey, it really hurts. Ow, it's horrible. And all these other things are also true. Great. Okay.
I'm just wondering if you could say a few words about what happens with any delusion in that moment of separation. I guess I'm worried about it. Or I'm concerned about it. But it occurred to me as I was experiencing the freedom moment of observation, or, you know, oh yeah, you know, it's not like that. Oh, then I jumped to, oh, is my mind trying to delude about this? And I don't know why it did that, but I just wondered if there was any comment or a thought that you had.
Yeah, so two things. One is a lot of what we're afraid of is not events, it's our experience of events. So what we're afraid of a lot is our experience of fear, if you think of it. And so the absolute bedrock of all practice is being with what's there. Radically, vulnerably, fully. And often we have to skip over to the third mode of practice, growing flowers as it were in the garden of the mind, to resource ourselves to be able to really fully be with this. Or sometimes we draw on other people to be with us while we be with it. A therapist, a friend, a guardian angel, you know, sitting in front of an altar, going in nature, you know. Nothing clears my head like the ocean, for example. You know, but so first and foremost is to really watch our own fear. We're often afraid to experience our experience. And yet, until we experience our experience, we're not free. It's the truth of our experience that sets us free. We have to really open into it. That's a fundamental teaching. That's always your first checklist item. Am I feeling it fully, right? And if I've tried to feel better and I've made wise efforts and I'm not getting much traction with them, you're not feeling it fully. You haven't felt it fully yet. I say that to myself, including feeling down to the younger, more vulnerable layers, more essential, the hurt that's under the anger, you know, the loss of status that's embedded in envy or resentment, right? Or fear of loss of status, let's say, for example, or the younger associations. So rule one, just always bedrock. And it's really interesting, like I've hung out with monastics of different kinds, and what's really interesting is how, partly because they have the time to do it, how fully they go into their experience. Like, I remember reading this one monk who was saying, yeah, I took 2 weeks to, I forgot what he was observing, I took 2 weeks to observe some incredibly small detail of experience. But he was really, and observing means he was really feeling it fully. So, okay, so number one, really watch that tendency to be afraid of your own experience and see if you can really open to it and receive it, to reclaim the vast estate of psyche you were born with and we tend to withdraw from. That's one. Two, go down into the body. What's the truth in the body? You know, what's real? Then I'm not deluded when I go down into the body, right? And as you do that, like you were saying about the parent observing the child, it's to trust your own witnessing, you know, to take refuge in your own seeing of what's true. And I trust your capacity to see what's true. You know, really, I trust that in other people, deep down. Claim trusting in that yourself. Otherwise, you're screwed. You know, look what happens in a sick family system or organization or country. What's the first thing that they do when there's a coup d'etat? They take the TV station. They take the communications medium. Or the first thing they try to do is they get people to not trust their own capacity to recognize truth. You don't know what you're feeling. I know what you're feeling. And it's vastly important to reclaim for yourself as your fundamental primal refuge, your autonomous freedom inside the temple of your own mind to claim what you feel and know to be true for yourself. Really, really important, really central. I'll say that. Great. A couple more people, and we'll try to not go too late tonight. Yeah.
I think that explains that sense you have when you feel terrible and you turn to a friend.
Yeah.
And they always, not always, I mean, the disappointment is when they try to discredit your experience to make you feel better.
Yeah.
Instead of what I hear you saying is if they would leave you with how bad you feel, it'd be those other energies that you're talking about.
Yeah.
It would be so helpful.
So well said. Yeah, that's right. And to practice that ourselves. Yeah, it's weird. If it's a kind of fearlessness, you know, where we're willing to receive fully what's true in ourselves or true in the other person. You know, it's like a kind of jujitsu. Yeah. And again, don't forget the recognition of the nature of experience. You know, that's one of the most radical teachings of the Buddha, is recognizing the unclingability of all experience. We don't recognize that, but when we recognize it, then we become free in our relationship to it. Empty, foamy, like a cloud, not like a brick. Okay. A couple more? Yeah.
Well, quickly, what you were saying, I've been in groups where we share something called a fear profile, which is basically what you're saying.
Huh.
And nobody comments on anybody else's, but just the commonality. Like, we all have these freaky feelings and thoughts when we're afraid. And so it makes it not personal.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting how quickly it drops away. But I even experienced it here when you were walking us all through it. It's like, we're all having this experience. I mean, we all have this same mechanism.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you. That's great. Yeah, last person.
I was just noticing this kind of cascade of things that were coming up for me. For one thing, being in the body and just feeling the feelings, I felt much more grief than I imagined I would. Mm. And then when you said go to thoughts, I felt this profound relief to get back in my head and have the opportunity to talk myself out of it. And then I noticed that and said, you know, that's, you know, just notice that I'm doing that.
Yeah.
And then one of the things, since I've started to come to this meditation, it's a muscle that I'm working on, is to strengthen the self-compassion muscle of just noticing that my fear is so normal and just about the lizard in me that's trying to survive.
Yeah.
And kind of just making it a basic thing of just, you know, whether it's my job or my child or my relationship that I'm trying to preserve, just saying to myself, you're just being human. And that little bit of dopamine that gets squirted in with the serotonin and oxytocin makes me feel a little bit better to, you know, help out my amygdala in that moment. And that's how I think about it, you know.
Yeah.
Just based on a lot of the stuff I've read of yours and the stuff that I do in my spare time.
That's right.
But it really makes me feel better instantly, even if I still am kind of left with a moment of just kind of sitting in sadness, which feels okay.
That's great. Well, thank you. So well said. Huh? So if I could, I want to leave you with a very short story, true story that I read, and then we'll just sit for about 1 minute, kind of help it sink in. And the story is a monk in Thailand is telling the story. I think it's Thailand, definitely Southeast Asia. And, you know, the monastics there, these are poor countries in general, and the monastics themselves live very, very frugally. They might have one meal a day, some rice, and they don't have access to great medical care, including dentistry. So this particular monk had a really, really, had major tooth decay. His tooth was really hurting, okay? And he needed to pull it out. So he actually walked to the garden shed, picked up a pliers, placed it on his tooth, and yanked it out. So then he's telling about it now. Okay, so that was the trigger warning. We just went right past that. So someone was asking him, just like you're kind of vicariously feeling, oh my goodness, how did you handle that? And he said, well, and this is how he talked about it. You know, as I was lifting my foot to walk to the tool shed, there was no pain. Right? As I lifted my other foot to walk to the tool shed, there was no pain. Okay. So I got closer, there was no pain. So I reached and opened the door, there was no pain. So I stepped into the shed, there was no pain. As I reached for the pliers, there was no pain. As I held the pliers in my hand, there was no pain. As I placed the pliers around my tooth, there was no pain. As I squeezed and pulled, there was pain. And then after I set the pliers and tooth down on the shelf again, there was no pain. You know, you see, right? Now that's a high bar. That's a lot of practice. That's a lot of training and marinating in GABA activity, as it were, and, you know, natural opioids of well-being and loving kindness and all that good stuff, right? Right? But still, if you think about it, so much in life, in this moment, there's actually no pain. Right? We're really caught up in anticipatory anxiety. And, you know, what's the line? You know, the hero dies but one death, the coward dies a thousand deaths. I got that wrong. The coward dies a thousand deaths, hero dies but one. Something about that. Okay, so you got the basic story. How about we just sort of marinate in this? And this week I really invite you to open into, you know, just your experience really fully. See what happens when you don't defend against it. You don't resist it. You listen to it, you know, you cherish it like a hurt part of yourself, like a little kid, okay? And then next week I want to talk with you about some of this really neat stuff I'm learning about how to help ourselves really learn the good stuff. Okay, so let's sit for a minute. See if you can have courage about fear. Be well. Take care.